I'm Doug Farrer, and this is The World Unpacked.
China has largely adopted Russia's talking points, actively helping the Kremlin disseminate its version of the bloody war to millions here and beyond.
China and Xi Jinping have been quiet, if not reluctant, partners of Putin amid the brutal invasion of Ukraine. Inside China, the CCP has employed the full force of its propaganda machine to parrot Kremlin talking points, while Chinese officials take a more measured approach. Joining me to unpack China's tightrope act on the war in Ukraine is NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Feng. Here we go. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found your way to Beijing.
I actually wanted to move to Myanmar at first, and I had just graduated college. I didn't have any job prospects. And the last couple of months of college, I actually, instead of going to class, I just took off and I went to Burma, Myanmar. And I found the journalism scene there to be really exciting. The country had just transitioned to democracy. They'd held a vote and elected Aung San Suu Kyi. But it just wasn't as developed as I'd hoped it was going to be. And rental prices were really high because the U.S. embassy had massively expanded its presence there. So I crossed that off the list, but then thought, oh, I have some friends in Beijing and I speak the language. And I'd met some journalists there previously and thought they were super cool. So one thing led to another, and I ended up freelancing in Beijing for a few months before joining the Financial Times, and then I joined NPR. So here I am today.
Well, we're so glad you're there, and I know how challenging it's been for Western media in general there, so appreciate the on-the-ground perspective. So let's talk about this invasion. Over here, when the invasion occurred, there was a flood of social media posting, a lot of hashtags, a lot of use of the Ukrainian flag, and it's just been a dominant conversation online. Tell us about the reaction in Beijing on Chinese social media and among people you talk to about the invasion.
On the day of the invasion, there was actually a few hours of silence where news about Russian troops crossing the border into Ukraine was going on international news. But there was basically a headline blackout in China, and that's because they hadn't figured out what their line was going to be. But that very day at 3 p.m., there's a regularly scheduled foreign ministry press briefing every day. And at that press briefing, Hua Chunying, who was one of the main spokespeople, came out with this line, NATO still owes us a debt of blood. So what she was referring to was the 1999 NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And she brought this up because China, at that point, was already starting to set the foundations of their very anti-NATO and anti-US response to the Russian invasion. They cast the invasion from the beginning as a result of NATO expansionism, as the result of US provocation. The Americans had been sending arms constantly to Ukraine and had made cautious overtures to a burgeoning Ukrainian democracy. And from then on, that line has really taken off, the line that NATO began this, the U.S. is somehow responsible, and that Russia and Ukraine are reacting to external stimuli rather than perhaps any kind of internal political logic behind the war.
So you mentioned the bombing in Belgrade, and obviously the Chinese state is always happy to kick NATO, especially after NATO, prior to the war, came out and sort of took a line against China as a potential new rival. But I also heard you say that they were still calibrating their response as this was happening in real time. Does that indicate to you that they weren't prepared for this to happen, or they were surprised, as we were in the West to some degree, that this war occurred?
This is the big question, right? How much did the Chinese leadership know before the invasion? And either answer is not very flattering. So Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia, actually visited Beijing in early February because he was one of the few foreign leaders present for the opening ceremony of the Beijing Winter Games. And he had a personal meeting with Xi Jinping. It was actually the first meeting Xi had had with a foreign leader since more than 2 years ago, because the Chinese leader has been completely walled off from the rest of the world due to the coronavirus pandemic. And at the meeting, these two leaders release a sweeping joint statement. You can go read it for yourself online. It's dozens of pages long. It covers everything from foreign policy to energy policy to industrial policy and how the two countries are going to cooperate in what they call a no-limits partnership. Fast forward just 2.5 weeks later, and Russia invades Ukraine. So many people here are asking, did Putin say anything about his invasion plans to China? If he did not, how deep is this partnership really? And why did the Chinese leadership agree to hitch their wagon to Russia, knowing that the U.S. was releasing, you know, open source intelligence, basically, about the fact that Russian troops were amassing near the Ukrainian border and were set to invade? Subsequent reporting from The New York Times has shown that U.S. State Department officials and intelligence officials had met repeatedly with Chinese consular staff, including the Chinese embassy in D.C., presenting them this intel and imploring them to say something to Russia to stop the invasion. Of course, no one is sure how far that intel traveled from the embassy to Beijing, to Zhongnanhai, the compound where Xi Jinping and other top party leaders live. But you must think that they had some kind of inkling that Putin had ambitions to invade Ukraine. This is, you know, the second troop buildup that he's had in the last year or so next to Ukraine. If the Chinese leadership didn't know, then this seems like a massive intelligence failure and a failure of decision making at the upper echelons of the Communist Party, which has been increasingly distanced, I think, from the rest of the world and even from parts of Chinese society because of the pandemic and the very strict controls China's taken. So people are still trying to figure this out. The Chinese ambassador to D.C. went on Face the Nation over the weekend.
You know, we will do everything to de-escalate.
And he has stated repeatedly in an op-ed he wrote and in that interview that China had no idea whatsoever. And if they had known, they would have done their utmost to stop it. But as you mentioned, the messaging is different in China and outside China. In China, it is very much focused on how the U.S. allegedly provoked this invasion. And outside of China, China has been trying to present this image that it wants peace, that it's neutral, that it had no idea what happened, even if that makes it look a little bit foolish, but that China is positioned to broker any kind of diplomatic negotiation to end the war.
I want to return to Putin and Xi and the political leadership here in the back half of this episode. But before we get there, I want to give listeners a sense of how this is playing in China when you talk to people, sources, people in Beijing, people in the countryside when you travel. And so let's start by examining how much is Chinese media and propaganda sort of taking whole hog the Russian narrative around this invasion? Or are they sort of setting their own course?
It is very, very pro-Russia at this point. You have started to see some reports about Ukrainian civilian casualties, Russian attacks on residential city centers and Chinese state media. But from the very beginning, the overwhelming tone has still been that of how NATO started this incident. There have also been reports where reporters have been deeply embedded in the Russian front lines in, say, the Donbas region in Ukraine, which has raised questions about how those reporters got there in the first place. And on social media, particularly social media accounts run by Chinese state outlets that are directly overseen by either a government or a party-controlled body, you've seen those social media accounts simply just reposting dubbed versions of Russian disinformation. I've seen Xinhua and People's Daily, so the two biggest state and Communist Party respectively run outlets here in China, post videos that Volodymyr Zelensky had fled the country. You know, these rumors that he had to go on YouTube repeatedly to dispel. I've seen them post videos suggesting that there are U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, an allegation that U.S. authorities have denied over and over again and that China has not presented evidence for, though it cites Russian defense intelligence as backing up those claims. And once those claims are seeded on Chinese social media, they've been escalated and amplified all the way up to the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson, who has repeated this numerous times at press briefings, and the main evening news, which is the most watched news program in China. So there's been this curious, almost like Russia Today kind of stream of information within China, while at the same time, Chinese foreign ministry officials are still doing their daily business through video chats, through phone calls with other foreign leaders, and presenting a much more balanced line about how China is still trying to broker peace in the region and sending humanitarian aid. But there's that disconnect, and it's been very, very strange trying to explain that experience to people. If you're living in China and consuming state media, you're getting a very different story about what caused the conflict. It's the U.S. and NATO. But if you're listening to Chinese foreign ministry officials trying to maintain their open channels of communication with the leaders, you get the sense that China has not yet decided what it wants to do and that it's still open to perhaps pushing Russia to come to the table and to help Ukraine. But I think you get that disjuncture because China is trying to remain neutral while hiding its real interests, though its interests are quite obvious. It best case scenario would love Vladimir Putin to win this war, to destabilize NATO, destabilize Europe by having a massive refugee crisis in Europe, and also distract the U.S. from what is its real great power competition of the century, which is competition with China.
I want to stick with the propaganda for a second. We know, because we work with colleagues in Russia, and you've talked to some of them on your program, that Russian state TV is an incredibly effective propaganda tool in Russia. I mean, there's a huge percentage nonpartisan polling that shows that Russians really support the what they're calling the special military engagement in Ukraine. They also even believe these ridiculous lies about denazification of Ukraine and so forth. How about Chinese citizens? Are they buying this? Are they sort of like the Russians, believing this propaganda, or are they sort of skeptical about what's being presented to them?
No, many people have bought into this, and you can't blame them because it is everywhere. It's on social media. It's also on television. It's also in their newspapers. Of course, there are alternative sources, and many, many people here self-curate their own list of outlets or chat groups. They have VPNs where they can access the rest of the internet that's not censored by China. But I would say the majority of people I've talked to, many people who work for international organizations or have studied abroad or are very, very well educated here in China, even Chinese employees who work for some foreign embassies here, who still believe that West knew fully what Putin's ambitions were, and they deliberately provoked him into invading Ukraine. Now, I personally don't agree with this viewpoint, but it's been very difficult to argue against that here in China because the groundwork has already been laid. There's been years and years of anti-US propaganda, some of it, you know, rightfully placed, perhaps, much of it exaggerated. And there's been a growing sense that NATO and Europe is being recreated in the Asia Pacific. There's been much more security language, of course, from the US and its allies with AUKUS, the Australia-UK-US alliance, that's specifically aimed at the Asia Pacific. And many Chinese saw that as NATO being created for the East Asia region. So what they're being told about NATO expansionism in Eastern Europe is something that they genuinely fear happening in East Asia and the South China Sea. So this propaganda has been well-timed, it's been well-prepared, and the audience here is receptive to this because it fits into their existing worldviews about how geopolitics works.
There were plenty of Chinese people who were living in Ukraine at the beginning of the invasion, and some of them may still be there. They're witnessing indiscriminate Russian bombing of civilian areas and all of the things that we're seeing here in the United States and in the West. Are they towing the party line too?
Not all of them. Many of them have evacuated, albeit through less than smooth processes. The Chinese government has made a really big point that they're there for every citizen who is stranded. But there has been some overt criticism that they did not, for example, notify their citizens ahead of time of the invasion and withdraw their embassy staff and their citizens like many other countries, including the U.S., did. That, China argues, is one indication that it did not know the invasion was coming. Otherwise, it would have told its people to get out. There has been one really prominent video blogger, Wang Jixian, who is still on YouTube, and he's been posting these daily updates. He's in Odessa. He did not evacuate because he didn't want to leave his friends behind, and also he didn't get clear instructions for how. He's been increasingly critical of Chinese nationalist opinions online that immediately started attacking him when he made these videos, saying he must be a paid foreign agent or some kind of foreign spy to say these anti-China things on YouTube about China. And since taking interviews from the foreign press and since making more and more critical interviews, he's made He's said that he's been directly contacted by Chinese security services about meeting up once he gets back to China, to which he responds, you know, I'm trying to survive here in Ukraine. This is the least thing I have to worry about. His accounts in China, his social media accounts, have been completely shut down. Like, he has no way even of opening a new account once the old one has been shut down. And you see him becoming increasingly alienated from mainstream discourse as he's become more and more outspoken. So in short, yes, there are Chinese people in Ukraine or living in China with Ukrainian friends who have been speaking out, but it's been increasingly difficult for them to do so because it's very easy for a very sophisticated censorship apparatus here to block those voices.
You talk to Chinese people every day and you work in Beijing. You also follow conversations online that are being had by Chinese diaspora. What are you hearing from them if they're expressing pro-Ukrainian views, and how is that being responded to by censors in the state?
Some of those comments do remain up, and there are pro-Russia comments that are also taken down, for example, if they're too violent. But overwhelmingly, the trend is that when you post something that's pro-Ukraine, you often get dozens of death threats. And depending on how viral that post goes, your pro-Ukraine post may also get taken down. So the discourse is subtly, or not so subtly, being shaped into a very pro-Ukrainian cyberspace, even though naturally I do sense that the genuine majority of people are pro-Russia, at least on this issue of the invasion.
When we come back, I'll ask Emily about China's position on Taiwan, about the no-limits partnership between Putin and Xi, and if there's anything the U.S. can do to get China off its pro-Russia position. Hey, thanks for listening to The World Unpacked. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a rating and be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
China needs to stand on the right side of history. It needs to ensure that it does not backfill financially or in any other way sanctions that have been imposed upon Russia.
I want to go back to the relationship Xi Jinping has with Vladimir Putin. Just weeks before the invasion, they declared a partnership that had, quote, no limits. But it seems like that the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin is testing that relationship a little bit. So would you say that the nature of that no limits partnership has changed at all as a result of this war?
No. In fact, I'm surprised it has not, because at the beginning of the war, I thought the West has come together. They've put these incredibly powerful sanctions on Russia. Even Singapore and Japan have joined in on some of the sanctions, which is really surprising. And China must realize that the geopolitical cost of being a partner of Russia is going to exceed whatever benefits it gets from signing this joint statement with Russia. Surely they will make actions to distance themselves soon. And they haven't. And I think that's because people have underestimated just how much China values the fact that Russia has destabilized the West in some ways, that it's distracted from U.S.-China tensions, and underestimated how much China wishes the America-led world order to be fractured, at least into regional blocks that China hopes to dominate. So I've been a little bit disheartened, perhaps, by how cynical this kind of realpolitik viewpoint has been, but China has not wavered in its position with Russia. It's said repeatedly that China is a friend of Russia's, that trade relations will go on as normal with Russia. China will obey American sanctions, but it's also not stepping down from the commitments it made to, say, buy natural gas and oil from Russia. And we're already starting to see some of the costs mount for China as it sticks with Russia. So oil prices here are also going up quite rapidly. The economy is slowing down, not only because of geopolitical concerns over Russia, but also, you know, there's an ongoing COVID pandemic and lockdowns here are still very much a thing. So there is going to be a cost for China sticking with Russia, but it's made its gamble. For better or worse, it will support Russia tacitly. It will not come out with any kind of diplomatic criticism of Russia, and it's just hoping that Putin does not get deposed as a result of this invasion. That would be the worst case scenario, that China's made this bet and that Putin is toppled from power.
I want to play this out a little bit because this is a really interesting point. I mean, we're 4 weeks into the war. It's kind of ground to a stalemate. It's unclear which direction it's going. In some respects, it's unclear who's even winning. And Putin, we know, and my colleagues at Carnegie have said, will do anything to win. Sure, the Chinese seem happy that the U.S. and Russia are in conflict and the U.S. is distracted from its pivot to Asia and all those different types of policies it's trying to undertake. But is China really willing to stomach support for Russia enough to incur potential sanctions eventually and then just the long-term economic pain of a grinding war?
Potentially. I mean, for all that I've said, China is still assessing its options, and it said as much. In the phone call that Xi Jinping had with President Biden just last Friday, China has repeatedly stated, and its foreign minister then went on several calls after that to state, you know, China has an independent foreign policy, which means that China is still sitting back and waiting and seeing what the best course of action is. But to sum it up, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's China's calculus so far, and it's quite cynical, as I mentioned. It could mean waiting out this war until entire cities in Ukraine are destroyed. But overall, it benefits China to wait until, even if there is some kind of stalemate, to then figure out what the geopolitical playing field is, step in and perhaps offer its services as a peace broker and come out maybe even looking better than it did before as a global player who has a stake in ensuring world peace. What was really interesting is I saw that the Ukrainian foreign minister tweeted out that it agrees with Beijing's position of wanting peace and that encourages Beijing to do all it can to play a part in negotiating a political end to this war. So I don't, we'll have to see what that means. The consensus has been that Ukraine would never accept China as a neutral third-party mediator to this conflict. But perhaps this tweet signifies that Ukrainians will take peace any way they can get it, and I don't blame them.
I want to talk about this idea of China as a diplomatic actor and potential peacemaker. I mean, when we hear about Chinese foreign policy, we hear about wolf warrior diplomacy and sort of an aggressive independent streak. I don't see them as much of a peacemaker in a diplomatic setting. And I'm curious from your context that you speak to on the ground, whether you think this is a serious offer or whether you think this is just a sort of talking point to show their neutrality.
It is just a talking point right now, but if Ukraine and Russia agreed to it, China would want to step in and host some kind of talks either between Russia, Ukraine, NATO, US, and Germany in itself, or just Russia and Ukraine. And they've said as much. With regards to wolf warrior diplomacy, that is certainly there. And you've seen some of those really aggressive diplomats in social media posting about how NATO has been the one that started this invasion. But those have not been the people who have been putting out the foreign minister statements or calling other world leaders about this issue. Those officials instead have been the much more senior, experienced diplomats like Wang Yi, China's foreign minister, Le Yuncheng, who just had a call over the weekend with Russian counterparts, the Chinese ambassador to the U.S., who sometimes is seen as part of the wolf warrior faction, but actually has been, I think, much more cautious in being both patriotic, but having channels of communication with his peers across the world. So these are people who do not have much of a social media presence and who have been putting out consistently basically the same language over and over and over again, which is we recognize that both countries, Russia and Ukraine, have unique security interests and historical reasons that compel them to be in conflict with one another, but we support peace and we deplore any kind of war.
Let's flip this around a little bit. You said, and I think there's broad agreement, that the Chinese view the Russia invasion in Ukraine as destabilizing for the Western-led world order, especially for the United States. But is there anything that the U.S. could offer to China to get them off their sort of pro-Russia position?
Now that kind of the cards have been played, Russia's invaded, China's partnered itself with Russia, the U.S. has started these very, very aggressive sanctions. Right now, the only way forward to change China's mind, potentially, would be to stick with those sanctions. China's now watching how the U.S. and its allies put up with these sanctions even when the economic costs start to mount, as supply chains start to get more and more snarled, as the cost for oil skyrockets. Will the U.S. and its allies stick by these sanctions when it really starts to hit American voters, say? China is counting on the fact that this coalition of NATO, Europeans, Japan, Singapore, the U.S., that this coalition is going to fracture or at least weaken a little bit when the economic costs of countering Russia's war in Ukraine start to accumulate. And it's hoping that that alliance doesn't last for very long and then China can step into the void. It's also taking some lessons about what might happen, say, if China invaded Taiwan one day, which is something that they've said could happen, and what the global response to that might be. How prolonged and how vociferous would the global opposition be to China, say, invading another entity? So what the U.S. and its allies do is going to be incredibly important, and that could affect what China does. It might make the case that the geopolitical costs could extend into the long term and may not just be a short-term pain.
What are Chinese business leaders telling you about the Western-led sanctions regime? I mean, we've all got concerns about supply chain. China is very dedicated to meeting its growth targets, and that's going to be really hard because of the war and the sanctions. Are they a factor in the conversation and the position of the Chinese on this at all?
Not necessarily, because Russia's economy is just so much smaller than China's. It's about one-tenth of China's. And Russia is not China's largest trading partner. The U.S. and Europe are. So in terms of actual sanctions with Russian businesses, yes, that does hurt a number of Chinese companies that historically have strong trade ties, families even that across generations have been living and trading in Russia and China. But the vast majority of the private industry here is still very much focused on the U.S., the Western world. So those sanctions don't necessarily hit them, though, of course, there are knock-on effects for the entire global economy that certainly will affect, say, consumer sentiment and demand for Chinese goods.
So we've talked a lot about how China and Russia have formed this no limits partnership largely because of the United States. But there's another big player here, and that's the European Union. China has a huge trading relationship and a much less contentious recent history with the EU. And I know there's a summit coming up on April 1st between EU leaders and Xi Jinping. What's the Chinese calibration on the European Union with respect to the invasion of Ukraine?
This is why China's been playing at the fact that it wants to be a peace broker. It is desperate to maintain its relationships with the EU. And you saw this amazing display of foreign policy going on during a recent press briefing the Chinese foreign minister Wang Yi had with the press in late February. Or was it late February? That he had in early March. He had this long, long press conference where in one go, he criticized the U.S. and said that U.S.-China relations were still on the wrong track. He warned Japan that if it kept doing what it was doing, that it would be in the same basket as the U.S. He praised Korea, which was just having presidential elections, and which China is watching very closely to see if it becomes more anti-China. And then it had very, very kind words to say to the European Union. Wang Yi stressed that China and the EU have long had ties and a very, very robust trade relationship. And so that reflected the fact that China realizes it's in a precarious position globally, particularly with regards to the EU. And throughout the Trump presidency and into the Biden presidency, you've seen the EU be this third party that China hopes will offer some levity to a still tenuous U.S.-China relationship. So China's been very, very eager to maintain contact with European diplomats to assure them that it knew nothing about the invasion, to emphasize the fact that it's sending, albeit very small amounts, of humanitarian aid to Ukraine, and that it's tried to keep up this relationship with the European Union.
China's looking at Russia and their actions in Ukraine and perhaps thinking this might be a real live simulation of what would happen to us if we decided to invade Taiwan. Do you see Chinese leadership taking steps already in light of what's happened to Russia and the reaction from the West to harden their economy or their society so that they could better weather these sanctions? Or do you think they're looking at Russia as just a small economy that's getting run over by the power of the West? financially?
I don't think it's an either or. I have not seen signs that China is planning to invade Taiwan any more so than I did before the Russian war in Ukraine. There have been many comparisons, though, made between Taiwan and Ukraine. Both China and Taiwan, I must say, have rejected these comparisons. But of course, there's this innate anxiety for Taiwanese, especially watching this war and wondering what would the world do if our much more powerful next door neighbor did decide to invade us. China has strenuously said, listen, Taiwan's just a different issue. It's part of our country, first of all, unlike Ukraine, which was a sovereign nation. You know, this is a contested point, of course. So China has tried its best to actually distance itself from these analogies made between Ukraine and Taiwan. But certainly, as I mentioned before, what the West does and how long it can continue going at it, despite the costs that it might incur for themselves to counter Russia, will be an important lesson for China if it ever considers a sovereign busting move like invading Taiwan.
Emily Feng is NPR's Woman in Beijing, and you should check out her reporting and follow her on Twitter at Emily Z Feng. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. We want to hear from you, so email us at podcasts@ceip.org. And you can find me on Twitter at Douglas L. Farrar. That's F-A-R-R-A-R. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button and leave us a review or a rating. The World Unpacked is produced by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Our audio engineer is Tim Martin, and our executive producers are Cliff Jayapranada and Clarissa Guerrero.